This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Michael Bradbury. Today is October 28, 2003. I'm again in the Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Bradbury is in Apache Junction, Arizona. Sir, yesterday we left off. You had come back from Quezon, gone to Da Nang, and we discussed a little bit there. I wanted to ask you one other question about Quezon.
Okay.
Did you and your men, when you guys came off the hill and eventually made your way to Da Nang, did you understand the significance of what had just happened and how the Quezon siege had played out in the United States and kind of what you all had actually accomplished?
No. No, we didn't find out any of that till later. In fact, you know, I've, through the History Channel on TV and just books I've read, I've learned more about Quezon probably in the last 15, 20 years than when I was over there. Again, you know, when you're a Lance Corporal, you don't get told anything about, you know, nothing. It's just, hey guys, we're moving out. And let's,
right.
You know.
How about today? How do you feel about it today, what you all did?
Well, I understand the importance of holding that ground, because you need to hold higher ground, because it's a lot easier to defend from up top than it is from the bottom. But it's hard to look at that, because when I think about Quezon, which was the biggest fight that the Marine Corps had over there.
Yes, sir.
You're a part of that, but you look at it overall, the whole Vietnam thing, we had no business being over there, and so when I'm thinking, about Quezon, yeah, we did. We extracted a lot of lives. We lost a bunch of guys, and it was all for nothing. In a way, it was kind of symbolic, I suppose. You know, Quezon, you know, when I go to San Diego to MCRD sometimes, you know, and I'll bump into people over there, and you talk to some of the active duty people, for example, they've named a street after us at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot over there, and they got the Quezon spelled wrong.
Really?
Yeah. And I went into the public affairs office there and told them about that. He said, "Well, that's the spelling we have. Are you sure?" I said, "I was there." And I said, "You know, we lost too many guys up there for that name to be spelled wrong on that street." So they said they look at. So, well, I got to do a lot of paperwork, you know, get things to the headquarters. I said, "Well, it needs to be done." I said, "You know, Iwo Jima Avenue and Guadalcanal Avenue is spelled right."
Right.
You know, we lost a lot of guys defending that piece of real estate. And it ought to be, it ought to be there. It's hard for me to say, Rich, the significance of what we did at Quezon, because you have to encompass the whole war. When you're up there swapping lead with guys that you don't even know, guys that you don't have anything personal against. These are guys who didn't attack the United States, who were over invading into their own skirmish. Not that I'm standing up for them, because I ain't. But those guys, and I've thought about this over the years, when you're shooting at guys that maybe in peacetime, you know, you and him might have been friends. You might have got, if you know these guys, you might have gone fishing together or something. They got a wife or a girlfriend. They got family just like you do. And the truth is known, they probably don't want to be out there any more than you are. And subsequent years back here, well, in fact, not very long, but a few years ago, I lived in a neighborhood where I had this. A guy across the street from me used to play loud music. He had wild parties, and boy, we used to have some go-arounds. And finally, I went to the police a couple of times, and finally the sheriff's office, and I said, "If you don't do something about this guy, then don't come after me when I do." And of course, when that took me, "Oh, you can't do that." I said, "Look, man," I said, "I'm losing a lot of sleep on this client. He's a pain in the butt." I said, "I spent 13 months in Vietnam killing guys I didn't know for no reason, and the government was paying me to do it." I got a reason here, so, you know.
Right.
And I thought about that, and I said, what was gained, what was for, and we gave it all back. We left equipment over there. We just let them take it over, and they took the thing over anyway. So Yeah, Quezon was a big thing. It was a big fight, but it won nothing. They rated in Marine Corps history, along the lines of Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, the Chosen Reservoir. But the difference is that, like with Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal, that was on our way to stopping Japan that was trying to dominate the whole world, including us at Pearl Harbor. I mean, there was reason for that. Mm-hmm. There was really no glory here. There was no, and again, like we talked about yesterday, no matter how many medals were given out and how many accolades, we came back here to nothing, to an unappreciative public.
Mm-hmm.
There were no welcome home, Johnny G.I., none of that.
Right.
And of course, the vet today is being treated shamefully. So, I don't look at Quezon the same way as, my uncles would have looked at Iwo Jima. We lost a lot of men. There was a lot of sacrifice. But was it necessary? No, it wasn't, because Vietnam wasn't necessary.
Hmm.
Can you tell me?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's just how I...
Okay. Tell me about the relationship you formed with the men up on Hill 861 and thereafter. What was that like?
Oh, it was tight. It was tight. Let me tell you, when you live, eat, sleep with somebody 24 hours a day, and you become tighter to these guys than you would a wife or a girlfriend or something, because, like back here in married life, you're in your house maybe half the day, the other half you're out working. You don't see them. Well, here you're with these guys 24/7, and you're sharing sea rations. You get down to sometimes where you're sharing the last canteen of water before you get resupplied. So you get to know these guys, and that you're outnumbered. You're always going to be outnumbered because Marine Corps is a small outfit. You know that from boot camp,
mm-hmm.
And so it's essential that each man look after each other and. The Marine Corps is not a bunch, it's a breed. We're a family. Today, 30 years later, we see each other in stores. We don't even know each other, but we see each other's tattoos or T-shirts, which we still wear after 30 years, which none of the other branches do. And we still got stickers on our cars, and a guy come by and see a Marine sticker on a car, and he's got one too, and he could get thumbs up, we're all brothers. And I'll tell you something that was refreshing over there that you do not see anywhere. Is it doesn't matter if you're black, white, or whatever. I've never seen any prejudice in the Corps. Everybody was olive drab. Every man I would rather, because you were dependent upon him. And I think if the war did anything, it showed me a lot, because I grew up with prejudice there in San Francisco where I grew up at. Mm-hmm. And if the civilian world could see how man is capable of getting along and working with each other. I mean, it's very possible, because we did it.
Right.
We're a tight outfit. That's probably where the Marine Corps has had the success that it's had over the 200 years, because we are a family. We're not just a bunch of enlisted guys tossed together.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is, you do your initiation, those who make it through boot camp and through the training, there are no black guys, no white guys, no Hispanics. We're all Marines. And it's not that way in the other service.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, yeah, we were all family, and we have the association, as you well know, because you were there. That's where you met a bunch of us.
Right.
And I think some of us have kept personal contact with each other, Doc Thomas and I,
mm-hmm.
So you develop relationships over there that you really won't see anywhere else, I don't think.
Well, let's pick up after Da Nang. You said you went up to Hue, is that correct?
We went to Hue.
Okay. And what was your assignment there in Hue?
I'm not sure. They just say, okay, guys, we're heading out. Sometimes you'll find out you're going to Hue City. We're going to do some clear and sweep. That was the proper name. It's really search and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up there. That was the second time in my tour that I actually got to shoot. Shoot the bazooka in anything other than practice.
Was this in May '68?
Yeah, this would have been Let's see, we got back to May, and then we got rid of the replacements. Oh, we got physical replacements, got rid of the short timer. Yeah, it would have been probably around late May of 68.
Okay.
We headed up to Way.
What did Way look like?
Well, Way had already seen some battle. You know, there'd already been some skirmishes down there. There were some destroyed buildings but then a lot of it looked like the war had just not touched it at all.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cathedral-looking old church there, which I had to help destroy because we drew some sniper fire out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it was almost looked medieval.
Okay.
I got some pictures that in fact I'll send you guys copies when we do the package and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some old Chinese, well, I don't know, Vietnamese really, but kind of Chinese looking pagoda temples that were still standing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it looked like something out of a real old Charlie Chan movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In places, of course, and it was surrounded, of course, by jungle and
mm-hmm.
you know. Palm tree looking things, and I don't think there were palm trees. There's some other variation of it.
Do you remember how the civilians treated you all?
Just at a distance, except for the kids.
Okay.
The kids, no matter where you go, because they were hungry, and we'd be telling them, and they'd always be, especially if we're on foot or riding the back of a truck or something.
Mm-hmm.
Kids would always come with their hands out and say, yeah, you give me chop chop. Now, chop chop, that means food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we toss a can of sea rats or something or whatever. But you had to be real careful. And they tell you about that at Pendleton too, because they would arm the kids with grenades. The kid that doesn't even know what he's doing. They'd,
mm-hmm.
they'd pull a string. Now, when I say they pull a string, the Gook grenades were like the old potato mashers that the Germans created. It was the grenade itself sat on the end of a long handle,
mm-hmm.
handle about 6 inches long, and it was a hollow tube handle. And inside that handle was like a twine, a hard, you know, a fairly firm piece of twine. And you would pull that twine from inside the handle, and then you could either toss it or whatever you're going to do. And they were quite effective because, like tossing a hammer, the centrifugal force, you can throw one of them pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
And what they would do, they would tie one of these to the back of the kid or stick it under his shirt, and they'd pull that string and then send him over to a group of GIs that were standing around and say, there you go, get some chop chop, go get some chop chop. And the kid come up, you know, and it's hard to, you know, turn your back on the kid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks in there among you, and unknown to him, and he'd blow up and take a bunch of your foot. So you had to be real careful. And when you got into places like Way, there you're getting into not just NBA but DC, which means that you might be looking at a guy that's a farmer
mm-hmm.
on the daytime, and he's waving at you, and he's out there with his water buffalo, and he's. Waving at you during the daytime. He might be out there laying traps at night. So, you know, you never knew who you were dealing with. So we were kind of waving at people, but we wouldn't get in close to them.
Right. What did you think of the Vietnamese civilians in general during your entire tour?
I thought they were a people that were caught in the middle of a bunch of crap. They struck me as just being people who were trying to get along and would have been just fine if some war wasn't going on.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, there are factions that want to take their country over, and there's, you know, they were helpless. They were there. They were just there to endure. They had no say what was going on in their country. They didn't know if they were going to get blown up or their village was going to get set on fire or who knows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the VC, of course, they used them a bunch. It would all either cooperate or they would get killed and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you never really, from our standpoint, you didn't trust any of them, but you felt sorry for them because you knew that most of them were just innocent people who got caught up in crap that wasn't of their own making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the poor guys had no place to go. You know, they live very poor. They live in grass-type huts, shacks, stuff put together with cardboard and sticks of bamboo. The monsoons would come and wash half villages away and whatever possessions that they had, which wasn't much. And then they'd have to rebuild somewhere. But they were mainly farming people who just trying to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, here are these communists wanting to take them over, and their own army is multiplying. Here come the Americans, and there's, you know, you felt sorry for them. But it makes you appreciate the own freedoms that we have in our country, which aren't so safe now anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say, man, boy, there for the grace of God, I could have been born here in Vietnam or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look what my family has. My family back home is eating turkey, and they're going to the movies, they're going to hamburgers, you know, and whatever they're doing, and they're going out boating for the weekend or this and that. And these people over here got nothing. Plus, they're being shelled. They got shells flying over their head. They're having to evacuate villages because what little homes they have are being burned either by us or by them because of the firefights. You know, it felt sorry for them. And you're thinking, you know, over what? And by the time I get back from Cape Town, we're going through Way and Quang Tri. A lot of things have stuck. A lot of, with me, my attitude was different when I came out of Cape Town because I'd seen the carnage, the uselessness of it. The first aid kits, which told me that our people didn't appreciate, as far as I was concerned, our people didn't appreciate what we're doing over here. The North Vietnamese is trying to just take over everything, and say, you know, there's a lot of people over here dying for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and these peasants, they're caught right in the middle, and all they wanted to do is farm a little, grow their rice, and just try to eke out a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and here's everybody and their brother, you know, swapping bazooka rounds, artillery, airdrops. You know, this is their home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why is this real estate so important to the communists? What is over here that makes us, and why are we over here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, even if the communists took it over, the Vietnamese people would be better off because there's a bunch of them over there today, just Vietnamese civilians that are walking around with no limbs, you know, because artillery fire is indiscriminate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're shooting this bad guy or they're shooting at you and your marksmanship is off a little bit and you blow up some little shack that these people, family is huddled together and there's a lot of walking casualties over there of people who are non-combatants. They just got caught in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want no part of it. Had no choice because it was thrust upon them. So I felt sorry for the Vietnamese people themselves.
How much do the men in your unit share that belief and that feeling?
I don't know. I would like to think that it was kind of a mutual thing, you know, because there was a lot of general feeling, well, I'm glad it's them and not us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At least we're going to get to go home. If we're lucky, we're going to get to go home if we don't get killed. And there wasn't too much talk about the Vietnamese people themselves, but at the reunions, you know, we'd get that around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So the reunion. So I would think that that feeling was pretty much mutual. There is more anger among the vets about anything about the way we did things, and mainly about the way we're being treated today and just forgotten about.
Right. Tell me what your impressions of Vietnam itself was, the country.
The country was humid. It was hot and humid and sticky during the summer. Then you got the monsoon rain.
Mm-hmm.
The land wasn't good for growing anything but rice and star apples. Star apples are, they're almost shaped like I said, I'd almost have to draw a picture of one, but they hung from the trees. You see star apples and stuff. The country is loaded with leeches, snakes. Yeah, well, you had to watch out for bamboo vipers and stuff.
Did you see any wild animals? Any snakes?
Yes. Saw one bamboo viper.
Really?
Yeah, we just kind of let him go because we were in a position there where he didn't want to fire any shots from where we were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes you get in a place where, you know, you don't want to make any noise, you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to, you know, along with watching out for, you know, bungee pits and booby traps, you had to watch out for the bamboo pipers. I only saw one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You had, what they call rock apes. And rock apes are like a derivative of almost like a small orangutan.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be in the trees, and they'd throw stuff at you.
Right.
Actually, toss stuff at you, and that's what they call them. I don't guess they call them rock apes in the medical books or archaeological books or whatever, but that's what we call them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only other animals we really saw over there were water buffaloes.
Mm-hmm.
And farmers would usually use those to pull their little makeshift plows and stuff. And you'd see some dogs. Sometimes you might see a couple dogs in the village.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about Wei. What kind of action did you see there?
We got into, we were on the outskirts of Wei, and we do some, I was back near the rear of the column, and the only action that we saw in Wei ourselves was on this one particular day. They were drawing, we heard the machine guns up at the front of the column, and they were, you hear the M60s chattering, and so everybody just kind of, got down, just looked at everybody, just, you know, looked in both ways and everything. We were laying along a dike.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the second time in the 6 or 8 months I'd already been there that I got called for rockets up.
Mm-hmm.
And word came down, so myself and our assistant gunner, we went running up there. By the time we got to the front, we saw there was sniper fire coming out of this church, and it was an old, I don't know what kind of Buddhist church or whatever it was, I don't know what it was, but we were drawing sniper fire, and so the lieutenant, he said, we need to take it out, and, some machine guns were having pinned down, and I had some second thoughts, I didn't know the Lord back then, but even then, I said, I don't think God's going to smile on this taking out of church, and, because this is a house of God to somebody, but on the other hand, you're drawing sniper fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I opted not to go with the law rockets, to go with the big tube.
Now, did you say that out loud, or were you thinking that?
I was thinking that.
Okay.
You're not going to disobey orders.
Right.
Lieutenant says take it out. Well, you take it out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you do. We Marine Corps, we don't have encounter groups or discussions about
mm-hmm.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the guy over you has only one more stripe than you do, it's the same as if he was the commandant,
mm-hmm.
as far as you're concerned. You know, mm-hmm. that's what you do. So we went with the big tube, and I put two rounds through it, and the second round did the most damage, and the guys who were still in there, there was a few of them, they went running out the end of the building in a panic, you know, and as they did, our machine gunners chopped them up.
Mm-hmm.
But and that was kind of a spooky part, a little bit for me, because the terrain where it was, I had to stand up to make the shot,
mm-hmm.
so to clear the backlash, and boy, and you always hate to stand up,
right?
You know, because you're everybody knows to lay down a good layer of fire for you, but you never know if there's some group sitting in a tree someplace that you didn't see,
mm-hmm.
and they tell you in rocket school, you know. You always want to make your first round count, because if you don't, and there's still some of them out there, all of a sudden, you just told them that there's a guy out there with a big rocket tube, and so you want to get him before he gets the second shot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first round took out a substantial part of this building, but Lieutenant Hardy says, swat them again, which means there was still some more building, part of the building left, and I said, oh my God, I got to make a second shot, and I just made the first one. Everybody and their brother knows I'm out here with the people, because it makes a horrendous noise. There's no recoil
mm-hmm.
on a bazooka, no recoil at all, because it all goes out the back. You just
mm-hmm.
hold through, but a tremendous noise and flash, and you know, when the thing hits, it just scatters block and brick everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to make a second shot, so I did that, and there were some guys that ran out, though. Out the end of the machine gunner finished them off.
Right.
Now, that was the only action that K Company saw.
How long were you in Way City?
I don't think we was there more than about a week.
Okay. And then you moved north?
Yeah, we went to Frank Tree from there.
Okay. And what was your assignment there? What did you all do?
You went
to Quaintree Town or to, up in Quaintree Province?
In the province. We weren't right in the town.
Okay.
We relieved another group of Marines that were there, and they moved on. And we sat in there for a couple, 3 weeks, and we just run a few daytime patrols. And and I don't know, I think it was just, you know, they shifted some of the units around. And, you know, if some area had been hard fought for, you know, you needed to hold on to it. Like, you know, when we left K-Town, we didn't leave until one of the other units came up and relieved us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this hill was hard fought for. It's vital. We got to, even if there's nothing going on here, we need to hold it to make sure they don't get a handle on this. One thing that happened in Dien Bien Phu with the French was that the French didn't believe that the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, would drag artillery up the slope, so they never thought about taking the higher hills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they found out wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And from the higher elevations, man, you can lob shells a long way. So even like when the thing was over at Quezon, before they finally evacuated the place for good, we still had guys up there holding it. So when we got to Quang Tri, we relieved, that was out to an area that had just been fought for also.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were tired, weary. They were going to send them back and get rid of some of their replacements, give them a little R&R time, and I guess we were probably the nearest outfit there. And, of course, the captain said, oh, yeah, we'll do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up taking over Quang Tri. Quang Tri was okay. We didn't get into any firefights with anybody. In fact, that was fairly pleasant. It was uneventful,
mm-hmm.
which was fine with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could finally go somewhere where everybody and his brother ain't trying to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran some patrols out of there, and we just kind of occupied the place for a couple, 3 weeks. Got in some letter writing time, and got some hot showers.
Right. How much contact did you have with home?
With who?
With home.
Not as much as I'd like to be, depending on the choppers, whenever choppers could resupply. And then sometimes we'd be so deep into some place, but they wouldn't send choppers. We'd pack a lot of gear, a lot of food and ammo, and you don't worry about mail till you get back, if you get back, because, you know, some places you go, you don't want to see choppers because you don't want the gooks to see choppers, because when they see choppers, they know that there's might be somebody in there to support, and we don't want nobody to know that we're there. So.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever we got, but communication was good. Whenever we got back into an area like Quang Tri or Dong Ha or someplace like that, and we were going to be there for a little bit, it was a fairly secure LZ. We'd get mail,
mm-hmm.
our mail, okay.
How important was the mail to you?
Oh, it was vital. It was vital because nothing made sense over Nam, and a letter from home told you that there was something to come home to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I mean, even if the streets were full of protesters, you knew that if you could get home and get home, you know, that's where your girl was, where your family was. You know, it gave you some kind of hope, and you didn't feel like things were so desolate. At Quezon, it was tough to get mail because every chopper that they sent. The caisson was vital to the goops, too, and you sent a chopper out. I mean, he knew. The guy flying it knew he was going to draw some fire someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a hard time getting supplies, and it was important to them. Somebody like the U-boat menace in World War II, the idea was to knock out the convoys to starve Britain to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and choppers, too, because when the goops didn't have it in it, the supply system we did. So we're up there on the hills, and they see choppers coming. That means the Marines are getting that. I don't think they were cared about cutting off our mail, but every chopper represented more ammunition for the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more food for these guys, more medical supplies. You know, we want to try to keep these guys marooned up here, so maybe we can regroup and try them out again, which never happened. But but they knew that's where our supplies were coming from. So you see a chopper coming, man, he was a. I often wonder if they paid them guys enough. But probably not. They were paid, for their rank. But you couldn't, man. I would never have wanted to fly a chopper because you're just such a target, especially the medevac choppers.
What was your experience with the medevac dust off choppers?
Well, fortunately, I didn't have to ride any.
Right.
But yeah, they draw fire. In fact, we had guys that were that were hurt and needed medical help, and we couldn't get them off the hill as quick as we'd like to, down to the main caisson base on account of the intense fire for the choppers. But it got down to where they bring a medevac chopper. He'd also bring in a sling sometimes with extra ammo and food.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came in to pick up the wounded, we could just go ahead and lay down a heavy fire all over the valley,
mm-hmm.
and just try to keep everything squelched so we could land, drop off, and, you know, of course, he'd bring a brief supply of ammo, too. But them boys did their job.
Mm-hmm.
They were, I can't say enough about the medevac guys, because you know you're your target. And the Gooks, and this is not new in warfare, they would rather wound. They'd rather wound you than kill you if they could.
Mm-hmm.
Because wounding you, they know that Americans don't leave their dead laying around.
Right.
If you can wound a guy, that's going to tie up 2-3 more guys to take care of him. And if you wound him serious enough, that's going to bring in a nice, fat, juicy target in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they can wound you, that's even better than killing you, because then they can entice more in. And, of course, now we had a strict code of conduct, though, about our own guys that they tell you when you get into combat, there's two guys that you be sure you watch out for. You watch out for your corpsman,
mm-hmm.
and you watch out for your radio man. You know, don't let that happen to him. So if a doc would have to drop down and take care of somebody, whoever's closest to him, get over there and watch his back,
mm-hmm.
because you might be the next one hit. And if the doc gets hit before you do, And he's out of action, then you get hit. Who's going to take care of you? Some machine gunner?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you watch out for your doc.
Right.
Yeah, but the group used that too, because they knew we took care of each other. So if you can just wound a guy,
mm-hmm.
that's going to tie up two more guys, because it's going to tie up the medical guy. It's going to, and maybe one or two guys to guard him. And if you wound him serious enough, that's going to bring in a chopper. And oh, what an opportunity we have here.
Right.
So
let's talk about. Just for a moment, about during your downtime and even when you were in the field, what did you all do for entertainment? How did you occupy your time?
Nothing. Just BS about back home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were no cards to play or nothing, and
mm-hmm.
You know, obviously no radios or TVs or anything like that. And, you know, and today, and I'm not knocking it. I'm glad to see they're living a little better. We've got enough. We did it for, you know, the guys could watch the Super Bowl, even in an Iraqi situation, and they lived in air-conditioned things, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I'm glad they didn't have to live like we did, but we didn't, we didn't have anything really to occupy our time except just each other. You know, everybody talked about back home or BS about what he used to do when he's in school or what he's going to do when he gets back, and that was good because, with two guys talk about what you're going to do when you get back home, that takes your mind off the fact that you might get killed. That means that you're planning on getting back home, so your attitude is good.
Right.
And you talk about, oh, my girl this, and she's going to do that, you know, and then we're going to do this, and I'm going to build that hot rod when I get back, you know. And it's,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty much what you do. Down to us, downtime is any day that you didn't get shot at.
Mm-hmm.
You're never really down because while some of the guys are resting or sleeping, at least a third to a half of the rest of the guys at any given time are on watch in the holes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you just sit there and you just do your job and just, you think about back home and stuff, but, you didn't have any form of recreation until you got back to Da Nang in between operations.
And what would you all do there?
Back there, they would show, outside movies.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have a film projector, and we'd all huddle in, and it'd be some movie that you wouldn't even go to see today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just some lame duck thing, you know, but it was tough. It was entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could shop at the PX if you wanted to buy something at the PX, like toothpaste or maybe even a can of pop or a,
mm-hmm.
although they used to be back in the rear, you could have a can of pop and a can of beer each day out of this free cart,
mm-hmm.
but you could only have either one or each, or some guys do if they were beer drinkers and the other guys weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a guy would take a Budweiser and an orange soda, and he'd say, well, I'll trade you you don't drink beer? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll trade you my orange soda for that beer you got.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd end up with two beers, and the other guy would have two orange sodas, and that would work out pretty good.
Mm-hmm. What about drug and alcohol use?
Well, the only alcohol I ever seen over there was just beer.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and they only give you two cans of it.
Right.
A day, so there wasn't there. I've heard about drug abuse. I've never seen it.
Okay.
No, I've never seen it. I don't know where the guys would get it.
Mm-hmm.
It really, you know, out where we were. But I'd heard about it. You know, you hear about so many things in the media, you know, and people ask you, you know, when I got back, they say, hey, you know, we read about this in the Times or the Chronicle, you know, is this all? I said, wait a minute, where'd you hear that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what the newspaper, and I said, man, you can't, you know, don't take that as gossip.
Right.
Hey, you know, we had a lot of coverage on Kason for reporters who never got up there.
Mm-hmm.
The main, most if not all the photos you'll ever see of Kason were taken by guys like myself that just submitted films into different places for archives or actual Marine combat photographers.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the stuff that you hear in the newspapers, they always painted a darker picture sometimes than what it was.
Right.
And I get a letter from home. I get letters from home. My mom and dad, they write, and they say, oh, Mike, man, we hear you guys are this, that, or the other, you know. And I said, wait a minute, we're talking about the same outfit here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I went back and I said, no, that's not so. So we had a lot of straightening out, too, when I got back to this. Because you got to remember, the newspapers are... The news media in this country is fairly liberal, and you know, people dwell on bad news. You know, one of the TV evangelists, John Hagee, said one time, you know, if you want the blues, watch the news.
Mm-hmm.
You can't turn on your television, Reg, and hardly ever, and see a bunch of good things that happen in the world today. Everything is tragedy. That's what seems to sell. That's what they're And Vietnam was not a popular war, so if you can paint the picture with different shades of this and that and make it look darker than it is, you know, you might get the people more riled up. But
mm-hmm.
but I blame the media for a lot of that, because we came back and we were being painted as people, guys just burned down villages and killed and maimed women and kids. And I said, where in the hell is this coming from?
You didn't see any of that?
No. I saw a village. I saw a village get burned one time, and we sent our Kit Carson scout in. Kit Carson scout is a former North Vietnamese or VC,
mm-hmm.
who we take in under what they call a Chu Hoi program, and that's the guy who's defected. He's had enough,
mm-hmm.
and we had a kid with us that he'd be so upset with his own outfit that he'd be glad to work for us. And then, of course, they do a reindoctrination, and to show his loyalty, he always wore. These guys always walk the point.
Mm-hmm.
And the old man would send him in to a village. We're coming through someplace, you know, where we hadn't been, and he'd get, and this guy would seek out the village elders and tell them that there's a unit, he wouldn't say, well, how big, a unit of Marines coming through.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys are hiding any VC in here, you need to flush them out, let us know, because if we draw any sniper fire out of here, you know, and those elders, you know, they'd say, oh, well, no, there's none here. Of course, they might have been scared, you know, to say anything, because they might have somebody with a gun on them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chu Hoi guy would tell me, he said, now, you know, if we draw any sniper fire, we're going to level this village,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we're not losing a bunch of guys over a bunch of BS.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through this one village, and I wish I could tell you where it is, but I don't remember. But I remember we were going through, and we drew some fire, and you heard an exchange of fire. I didn't always get up. I wasn't always up in the front of the formation. They kept the hard weapons near the back of the formation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was on all the movements, all the patrols. But they used to keep the machine gun teams up near the front. So that's where your initial contact. That's where you want your machine guns. The hardened weapons, they'll call you up 50 or 60 yards to the front of it if they need you to take out something hardened. So, but anyway, I'd heard what's fire going on up there, and the word starts rolling down through here, and all I could hear was up, 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 and I thought, oh, rockets up, here we go again. Well, and by the time it got down to me, it was flames up, well, here comes the guy with the flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck? And before you know it, man, the build, by the time everything settled down, the column started moving again, we got to the village, and it was on fire.
Mm.
And, we knew about what happened, but that wasn't where, a deal with the media report. Now, if the media had known about that, and one of the reasons you hear about Lieutenant Calley and the Army and all them guys in there, that you didn't hear about us, we didn't take the press with us.
Mm-hmm.
The Army likes to take press with them to try to glorify all their events.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't take press. In fact, most places we were, the press wouldn't go anyway if they had any sense. But we went on through there and the whole, village would be on fire. But if the media, for example, had gotten a hold of that, there wouldn't have been anything mentioned about that we gave them warning first and still took sniper fire before that. So they said, oh, the Marines just went in there and just charged the village, killed all the, that's how it would have come out in the news.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the public was very misled. Very misled.
Did you ever take any R&Rs?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I went to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go there and actually, I personally violated the rules. I guess I can say that now because it's over because you weren't supposed to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But why Hawaii was expensive and I said screw this, I'm gonna go home for a few days. So when I got into Oahu, I went ahead and bought a ticket, flew back to California, spent a few days with my folks.
Mm-hmm.
And then flew back to Hawaii, and then took off from there and on back to Da Nang. I said, screw it, I ain't staying in Hawaii. I want to go home.
How was it when you went home?
Well, everybody was glad to see me, and they would say, oh, man, do you have to go back? I said, man, I ain't supposed to be here.
Right.
I said, I'm just, and that's where we got into some of those, and this is after Quezon. And my mom and dad showed me a lot of pictures that were in the newspapers and talked about this and that and the other, and I said, no, that isn't right there. And I said, this isn't how it's going. And I remember my dad asked me, he said, Mike, what the hell are we doing over there? And I said, I don't know. This is after Quezon and after the exchange I'd had with Sergeant Ackers, about all the firepower we have, we're taking this every day. And I told my dad, I said, Dad, I don't know what we're doing over there. I said, we're just killing a bunch of people. We get a bunch of people lost. And he says, is there oil? Is there gold over there? I said, there's nothing over there but leeches and snakes and swamps.
Mm-hmm.
I said, man, if the North Vietnamese wanted, God, man, let them have it. This thing worth fighting over. I said, Dad, and this is when I was a little more flag waving than I am now. I said, I'm sure the government knows what they're doing. Because I was still a young kid, I said, well, we don't understand everything, but I'm sure the government knows what they're doing. We wouldn't be over there if there wasn't a reason. Well, guess what, But, it was tougher leaving then because then I'm home amongst friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I'd already been over there. I think that's why they don't want you to go home on your R&R. Because you get back to the States and get out of that crap, and they think you're going to go AWOL or something.
Mm-hmm.
He said, man, how can I get back here amongst the girlfriends and the roast beef and everything, and then willingly turn around and go back to some place where I know what it is over there, and I may not come back.
Right.
That's why they don't want you to come back. But I went ahead anyway, and I went on back. I said, well, I don't want to be AWOL. And
did it help you when you got back in country?
Yeah, it did because it just made me even more aware. So now I have got to make it out of here, man. Because after I've seen, especially how you see how the other people live, how the Vietnamese live, and then you come back for your own taste of reality. So man, we got it so good over there. I got to get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate to be over here now for sure, man. I do not want to get knocked off or killed. So you're really a lot more aware of it when you, because you get a taste of what the real world is, and it's not like over there. And said, I got to get back to that, so I'm gonna, just not allow myself to be complacent or lackadaisical. And you get into day counting, to get into day counting. How many I got left? You know, that I got and said, I got to get out of here.
What did you think of the policy that you would do 12 or 13 month rotation? Did you think, you know, in World War II that you served the entire conflict? Did you think that the policy for Vietnam was appropriate, or did you think that the men should be there for the entire duration of the war?
No, well, I thought we should have been over there until it was done.
Mm-hmm.
But now when I look at it now, I'm glad I did, because that thing dragged on for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't have to, see, because in World War II, we were going all out to win it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter what we had to do, including dropping the A-bomb at the end.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the, and here we were just dilly and dally. We were a test bed, and there was, and you know, it's something else I found out, and I'm sure there's no strangers to the American people, is that there was a lot of people back here in the States, a lot of entrepreneurs that were making money off that war.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money, man. The oil companies supplying fuel for the jets, the people making the armament, the people who made your sea rations and food. There was a lot of money to be, a lot of people made money off that thing to keep it going. And we weren't doing anything to win this. And after Quezon, I was glad that there's only going to be a 13-month, he said, we're not fighting this thing to win it. We're just going over, holding a piece of ground, you know, and we're still dinking with these guys. And we had to come from way behind, and it only took us 4 years to whip both Germany and Japan from across great oceans.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because everybody was behind us back home.
Mm-hmm.
The women were working in the factories, building the airplanes. People were rationing. Whatever it took to get that job done, the people were behind us, and we weren't pussyfoot. We had guys like Patton, you know, rolling through everything. And say, you know, ain't no rules there. You know, you're going to wait till you get shot at first. You can't go over this line of this parallel baloney. You know, we're going after Hitler and Hirohito, and we're going to knock these guys out. We're going to end this crap.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't see that in Vietnam. And so I'm glad it was only 13 months. I said, man, you could be here forever, and your chances of getting back would almost be nil because we're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that to be true when we walked out of there in 75. And if you see, looking at the monuments that they have in D.C., I've never seen them personally except in pictures, but you look at the Iwo Jima Memorial and some and the one they're doing for World War II and Korea and all, and Civil War, and ours is just a big slab wall with 58,000 names on it for nothing, for absolutely nothing. So on retrospect, I'm glad that we didn't. I'm sorry we was over there to begin with, but if we had to be over there, I'm glad that we didn't go more than 12. We called 12 and 20.
Right. Okay. Let's get back to Quang Tri. You said you were there for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And where did you go from there?
We went to Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And we operated out of there, ran a few patrols.
Mm-hmm.
We had a skirmish across the dike, exchange of fire, and of course, we didn't have artillery with us because we were mobile at the time. We called in a couple airstrikes, and they naped them, napalm.
Mm-hmm.
And they took care of that. And really, there was, for my unit, there was no more what I would consider major heavy fighting from that point on. We got into a situation at Hill 55.
Mm-hmm.
Which was an almost bazooka thing. That's an interesting story I need to tell you about.
Okay, go ahead.
We got to Hill 55, and the South Koreans had just had a skirmish there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had done, they were attacked by a wave of them, and they opened up their own gates and let them in, and then killed them all hand to hand when they got them in there. And they still had a couple of them that were dead, and just still spread out on some makeshift poles when we got there. We walked in, it looked like walking into a Zulu camp or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these dead dudes strung out, just dried up, just dried blood laying everywhere. And South Koreans were using them for target practice. You know, they're just, I said, holy moly, well, at least we're setting in with the South Koreans, so we're good to go.
Right.
So we probably don't have to put anybody on guard tonight, you know, with these guys here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I was there, and I wrote about this in my book, if I ever get that finished. I'm sitting here, and I've got maybe 2 months left in country. So I'm I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've already been through, several skirmishes. The big thing at Quezon, went home to see the folks, which I wasn't supposed to do, but mm-hmm. then came back, and I'm still ducking and dodging, and I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I got about 2 months left, okay? So if I could just wind up these last 60 days or so, I'm home free. I'm out of here. Middle of the night, I was sleeping because my watch would be on more into the evening, and they came and woke me up. And they said, "We've got some action." What do you mean action? You know, we come out there and they grab the tube, come out there, and you could hear there was a tank out there.
Mm-hmm.
Just out past the room there, and it was dark. You know, this must have been 10 o'clock at night or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you could just hear the treads on this thing, just clankety, clankety, clank, you know, and everybody was on alert. And they got a hold of CP, you know, and our radio man was trying to figure out what was going on, and the captain ordered the rocket team, you know, because anytime you're dealing with a tank, you know.
Right.
Now, I'd never shot at a tank except in at Camp Pendleton. We used to take them old derelict tanks that they were going to scrap anyway. We used them for targets. So, anyway, so I grabbed the big launcher, which doesn't matter because it's at night. You can't see down the sights anyway, so if you're going to shoot at something, you're almost using Kentucky windage.
Mm-hmm.
So I got John Bosch with me. He's my assistant gunner, and we go down there. And they get us down along in the trench there, close to where this thing is. And he's out there maybe 70 yards. And just I'm thinking, oh, man, not now, you know. I'm 2 months away, and I don't need this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand, in rocket school, we learned a lot of things about the two different tanks that the Gooks had. We're all Soviet-made
mm-hmm.
T-72s and the T-76s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to tell the difference at night. And the 76, they used to tell us it had an infrared thing in it, to where it could pinpoint heat and flash. So if you ever fired on one of these, you want to hit him because if it's one of the T-76 with the infrared, they'll know where you are, and they'll swing that gun around,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to, and a bazooka's capable of taking out a tank, but you got to make it hit. Now, this is a night, Rich.
Mm-hmm.
At best, you can see a silhouette sometimes, and not much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to look for the sweet spot. And the sweet spot on a tank is where the turret meets the body. That's mm-hmm. where the armor is actually the thinnest.
Okay.
You'll hear these old war stories, and it's, I don't know who made it up, but about knocking the treads off a tank. Well, that's stupid because that gun turret can swing 360 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can knock the tread off a tank, but he can still kill you. He can, as long as he can swing that gun and operate that thing, you can't get out of his range. They can shoot several miles, some of them. So, you know, and they tell you the spot to hit a tank is where the turret meets the body.
Mm-hmm.
And be sure you get him the first time, because if it's a T-76, and the guy who's watching the infrared, his little infrared screen is alert or awake at the time, he'll see where that came from. He'll swing that gun, and your butt's in trouble.
So could you see the tank?
I could see the tank, but just like a dark silhouette, you know, like you look out in your backyard at night and you got no lights except the moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
And you see somebody coming up the road, you barely see a pickup truck enough to know it's a vehicle, but you can't see
mm-hmm.
definitive outline.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm out there, and Bosch pulls out one of the rockets there, and 3.5 launcher. They're a big 90-millimeter rocket. I mean, more than enough to do a job. This isn't a job for the law rocket. This is mm-hmm. for the old tube. And so we lock and load. He gets the thing in there, taps me on the helmet, which is a sign that, okay, you're locked and loaded. Arming lever is up. You can squeeze off whenever you're ready. But we hadn't got the word to fire, because the word came down to hold fire, just lock and load, just be ready. So I'm out there listening to this thing, and you can still see him moving. You barely make him up through the darkness. And he stops. He just stops, and he's sitting there idling. idle in some more. And, you know, 5 minutes seems like an eternity
mm-hmm.
at that point. You know, and you know, a million things going through your mind then. You know, is this one of the 76s? Is this like the infrared? Is this, you know, if, you know, I've got to make this shot count, how the hell am I going to do that? I can't see through the sights. I know right about where he is. I can see silhouette sometimes through the clouded moonlight. And he's out there running. And I said, man, oh, man, I've only got 2 months left, and we got to get into this.
Mm-hmm.
We're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And Bosch, he gets over close to me, you know, and he leans over and he says, Brad. I said, what? He says, remember back at Pendleton? Remember at school where they taught us about these up-in tanks? And I said, yeah. And another moment goes by, and he says, Brad. I said, what? He says, Brad, you wouldn't miss, would you? And I said, shut up, geez. You know? And we're waiting. Pretty soon the word comes down to stand down. It said, unload. It said, it's one of ours. And it would have turned out to be it was an Army tank that had gotten lost out of his, he'd gotten separated from his formation
mm-hmm.
and was wandering around in the middle of the night.
Mm. Wow.
So our command post finally found out, got the coordinates, called their radio man in the tank,
mm-hmm.
and they shut the thing off and they got out. And we a couple of our guys escorted him in and said, we don't need you guys running around the middle of the night and go over a landmine or something.
Right.
He almost got blowed up here, you know.
Right.
And so the guys got out of the tank, came in through the wire, and they just spent the night with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the South Koreans were, who knows what they were ready to do. They were allowed to do so, but fortunately mm-hmm. nothing started. Then, so the next day it was, you know, bright sunshiny out you know, they climbed back in the thing, and I guess they got a hold of their own unit. They rolled off somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But in subsequent years at Marine Corps reunions, sometimes, you know, you get talking to some of the new guys and
mm-hmm.
or whatever, you know, and they say, what'd you do in Nam? I was a bazookaman. You know, I said, oh, you know, and one of the reunions, some guy says, hey, did you ever get a shot at a tank? And I said, well, I said, almost. You know,
wrong one.
Ours.
Uh-huh.
But, oh, man, I'll tell you, I must have aged 10 years.
Really?
Because, you know, it's the middle of the night, and if you miss, and he's got an infrared, which is sometimes heat-seeking, mm-hmm. body heat, and you don't,
mm-hmm.
you know, it becomes the advantage quickly shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Because before you can get reloaded again, you know, he can get one off at you and probably hit you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, tanks shoot big enough rounds, whereas they're just close, they do a lot of damage. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, when you get down to the last 2 months, you don't even want to see a gate.
Right.
You say, man, I'm this close now. Don't nobody start nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in the middle of the night, and this thing's out here running and idle. I can barely see him. I can't see him down the sight. I don't, you know, and I'm thinking he's an enemy guy. There's no reason to believe he's one of ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I've got my finger just inches from the trigger. I'm locked and loaded, and a million things running through my mind. This is going to be it. If I don't kick this guy, I ain't going to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Came down to one shot, you thought.
Well. If it had been a group tank, and it would have been an infrared.
Mm-hmm.
After my first round, if it didn't hit exactly where it needed to hit, and you couldn't guarantee that in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, because, you know, we didn't have the infrared stuff, the starlight stuff then, on some of our weapons that what they have now. So,
mm-hmm.
but the tanks were fairly well equipped.
Mm-hmm.
And his guns can, anywhere from 105 to 120 millimeter, well bigger than ours.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some armor around him unless you punch through that little sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, man, you know. In the daytime, you can pinpoint your shots, but at night, when all you can see is a silhouette, you don't know exactly where that thing is, and your sights are no good. We had pretty good optics on the old 3.5s, but they're strictly daytime.
Now, did you go back to your tent and go to sleep after that, or did you stay awake all night?
I was awake all night. I crawled back into the bunker they had there,
mm-hmm.
and I broke out in a sweat, and Bosch was in there with me. We shared that. Shared a bunker because mm-hmm. we stayed as a team.
Right.
And we just sat there just kind of looking at each other and said, God, that was close. And he said, well, man, I thought, oh, yeah. I said, Jesus, man, I don't need this. I got 2 months left. And Bosch had 5 or 6 months left. He didn't make it out. He was killed. Yeah, of course, we didn't know that at the time. But, man, I said, man, this is... And it was one turn up to be one of ours. I said, don't need this. I said, I just want to go home after this. And from that, from Hill 55, we went to High Van Pass. And I finished up my last month or two up there. And
What were you all doing up there?
We're leaving another marine out. It was a real piece of high ground that that overlooked the Anlo Bridge, and the main. We were up there with parts of I think 226 was up there also, and they were down further down the road. And the idea was to it was a vital bridge, you know, but these transportation to make sure the group didn't get a chance to blow it up. But we had plenty of marine elements all over it, and then on the other side of High Van, we had one of the Army units over there. So there were enough Americans over there where, I guess, where they didn't mess with us. So I guess my last month wasn't too bad. You just say, well, get up. And in fact, I didn't have any duties up there because I had a bunker up where up to the top of this one hill along this dirt road, and there were several other units around, and you weren't going to get called out. Even to stand watch because you had enough infantry with all the units that were there, you know. So you were going to sleep all the night and just kick back and do what you're going to do in the daytime if you were a rocket man, unless they needed you, to drop a rocket in somewhere. So I got to say my last month or so at Vietnam wasn't too bad.
Okay. Mike, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Sure.
Okay, we left off, sir, with you were basically getting ready to leave. You said that last month was pretty uneventful.
Well, I figured it owed me that after the tank episode. So the last month was uneventful. That works on you too a little bit. You get down the last 5 days and you got all these things running through your mind. You say, you know, I made it through all this and I'll watch something happen out before I can get out of here.
Right.
And that only really comes to fruition when you finally go back to the nine, you turn your gear in. Second to the last day, you turn in your rifle, in which case I swapped with another guy so he could have my M14, and I took his 16 and turned one in, which worked out for me because they issued me a 16 when I first got there, so I turned in a 16 when I left. And then you really feel vulnerable because now you got no armament at all.
Right.
And when you got to the runway, they had contract 707s that came in to get it. And all you could picture is going down the runway and having some duke on the end of a runway somewhere taking a pot shot and hitting the tank, and somehow you were going to have to put up with this whole mess only for them to get you when you left.
Now, did you think that was a possibility? Did that go through your mind?
Oh, yeah. A lot of things go in your mind, you know, because you put up with so much crap, you said, now I'm finally going to get out of here. And you said, oh, no, let's not get excited until it happens. And the plane was loaded. Marines and Army guys and stuff, and it was dead quiet on there. Even with the stewardess going back and forth, it was dead quiet in there. You didn't hear nothing.
Why was that?
Yeah, well, I think everybody was thinking the same thing. Maybe it's because when we got off, and the gear came up into the well, and we started to climb out and peel out. And everybody just broke out into a big cheer, just from dead silence to a big cheer.
Really?
So I think everybody was sweating. You know, because the thing does take rockets from time to time.
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, you're thinking a million things when it's like, you know, and 707 is a big target.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard to miss. And so, you know, the Duke's sitting on the outside of the city, maybe, out there with a 122 missile or and they were very good with those too. And mortars, you know, so watch us get to the end of the runway and they see this nice juicy plane. Oh, there's a chance to get a 150 of them at a whack, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel knowing that you were leaving? What was going through your mind?
Well, you know, in a way, I was sorry to leave because I didn't feel like we finished anything, and I left some friends back there that it wasn't their time to leave yet. And I said, "No, man, I hope you guys make it home. I hope I see these guys again."
Right.
And then it switched to when we get on near the end of the runway. I said, "I hope we make it out of here." He started. It was probably the only other time besides other case time where I've ever actually felt scared to any Kenny DeGree. And mm-hmm. I said, watch it happen now. Mm-hmm. Sitting there loaded with fuel and a bunch of us and no way to fight back. Because, you know, we weren't allowed to take weapons.
Right.
Back to the station. Which was good for Berkeley College that we weren't allowed to do that.
Right.
But, then, yeah, like I said, finally when we got airborne and climbed out, it almost like on cue, the whole plane just let out a yay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then people started loosening up, the stewardesses, you know, they were all happy, you know, because they were, I'm sure they didn't want to be there either. And we flew, into Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there for 4 days, got one night's liberty on Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And,
what'd you do?
Well, an old buddy of mine that I was in Barstow with was stationed there during this whole time. He took me out to a town. We went out and had a few beers and, went to a cat house.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, just, party. We had an incident, a funny little incident happened there too. we had this one guy that was come in drunk and just raising all kinds of cane and back into the barracks, you know, and you know, some of us were in there playing cards and this guy had been he was always the guy that was embarrassing people.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of guys went out of the barracks and they got a pickup truck. They got it out of the motor pool. Probably, mm-hmm. probably stole it. I'm sure they did.
Mm-hmm.
Brought it back. And this guy had already passed out in his bunk. And he picked up his bunk. He's laying there in his skivvies. Picked him up bunk and all.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in the back of the pickup truck. And they took it over in front of the officer's club. Dropped it off.
Okay.
In front of the officer's club. Then took off. And they came back. Put him back in there with us playing cards. A couple hours later, this MP pickup truck pulls up, and now this guy's in his bed.
Mm-hmm.
He's still in conked out, half in his bed, but he's half awake now too because he don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And MPs come in, and they got him out of the rack off their truck, and they said, "You guys know anything about?" Oh no, this guy's always doing goofy things. You know, he probably did it himself. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that was a kind of a little laugh we had there, but mm-hmm. but. The 4 days at Okinawa, we just kind of re-indoctrinated, and they checked us all over medically, make sure nobody was, you know, had any malaria or anything like that would come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave out orders. Also, you know, okay, when you guys, some of the guys were getting out of the court, and some of you guys were being stationed with him. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so-and-so, you're going to this outfit when you get back.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come back off leave, you know, everybody's going on leave when they went back. So, you know, and I was being reassigned to Camp Pendleton, so I knew where I was going.
Right.
And then on the fourth day, we took off. They flew us into L.A.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of scattered and went our own separate ways.
What was it like getting back into the United States at L.A. airport? Anything happen?
Well, I didn't see any protesters in L.A. I guess they didn't know when every flight was coming in. So for me, that again was uneventful, but I made a connection flight into from there to San Jose, and I flew in there, visited with my folks a little bit, picked up my car, and drove to Camp Pendleton to check in.
Mm-hmm.
But there were no great public receptions either.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like what you see in World War II.
Right.
Of course, there again, you know, when the guys came back from World War II and from Desert Storm, we had already won something.
Right.
And so all the crowds were out there to welcome everybody back.
Mm-hmm.
And even Desert Storm, you know, the Marshall Islands, they're minting special commemorative coins for this and that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnam guys were all just a bunch of scumbags, just baby killers and psychos and... So we just kind of dropped off into obscurity, which I'm glad there's outfits like you guys,
mm-hmm.
who are trying to make sure that doesn't continue.
Right.
So somebody will know we were around, and maybe for the right causes. So we've been mislabeled for just years.
Yes.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all a bunch of mercenaries or something.
Tell me about your transition. Back into life in the United States. You stayed in the Corps for another year?
No, I've been for about another 8 months. I only have about 8 months left on my enlistment. Yeah.
Did people ask you about Vietnam and what you had done there?
Yeah.
Civilians or military or both?
Well, civilians while I was home. And, you know, and you could see right then that that's when you really knew that you were misrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
Because they ordered you, you guys go cutting hairs off people, you guys do this, that, you know what I'm saying? Where are you getting it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, man, I said, no, it wasn't like this, it was like this. He said, well, you know, you guys getting fresh fruit, they were fighting fresh, we heard it the other way around, too.
Mm-hmm.
They were bringing you guys out fresh food, you guys were having hot meals, and I said, no, that was wrong, too, because this is how we live, you know. I said, you know, the Walter Cronkite's in the world, you know, they tried to go, but they go with whatever facts they think they have, and then if it doesn't sound juicy enough, they'll make something up, because I've heard of crap that I never heard of over there. I said, so, no, this is how it was, and then you get this from the horse's mouth, because I just came back.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get that. When I got to Pendleton and checked in, there now, I was stationed at Camp Margarita.
Mm-hmm.
And Pendleton is made up of several different camps. And Margarita was a staging area. And they put us in an old, what they call a short-timers platoon. Those of us who only had several months left.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have us help train some of the younger guys. And the outfit I was with there was 327. And I served with 326 and on. 327 was getting ready to go over. And so they had us old guys working with the young guys and trying to help teach them the ropes in their training. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, there was always no shortage of questions from the newer guys.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you guys, just a case line, you guys were a case line. You know, that's something that, you know, I've seen a couple dozen places over there.
Mm-hmm.
But all anybody wants to talk about is case on.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's because it was the big one, so that's one you always get asked about. So they said, you pass along with others. And so, they taught us in San Diego. And so don't listen. Most of that's good. He said, but let me tell you what else we found over there. You know, and you tell them. And he tried to help along. He tried to get a bunch of us to re-enlist of a short-timers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to entice us with a $3,500 bonus and another strike.
Mm-hmm.
Now, $3,500 is a lot of money in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there were, like, I think 22 or 23 of us. And none of us were re-enlisted. We'd had enough anonymous, so we ain't going back. And we knew if you re-upped, you were going to be in with the 327, and you're going back. And they said, no, we just come out of that crap. I said, we're not going back. So what they did, and this is probably the best duty I ever had in the Corps,
mm-hmm.
ever. They put us in barracks by ourselves, just all the old farts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I said old farts, we were like 22, 23, you know, the season's that
right.
Right. And they'd only use us about twice a week. So we'd go out and we'd do close order drill and do, you know, calisthenics stuff. But they would, about twice a week, sometimes only once a week, they'd load us up in trucks. And they'd take us over to Santa Ana for where some of the young guys are training. And they'd use us as the bad guys. We would be the guys,
mm-hmm.
that would lay along the trail with blank ammunition, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new guys would come in formation and we'd ambush them.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would be exchanging, you know, blank fire. And they'd have field judges out there to see, okay, who got killed, you know, and what we could have done. And, you know, and usually we'd have to let them know, we'd have to let the instructors know where we were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we didn't. We surprised them at coming out of the chow hall one morning before they even got in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how they used to do with us. When I was a young guy training at Pendleton, and we'd be going through the war games, there was always bad guys shooting at us. I always just wondered, who these bad guys are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just told the Marines who'd already been there. So we got to kind of play, we kind of got to be the gooks.
Right.
And we made good gooks because we'd been over there, and So you learn some of the things that over there that you can apply back here. So
mm-hmm.
we lay up in places on the trail where they wouldn't be expecting it. So about once, and then sometimes twice a week we'd they'd take us out there and we'd be the bad guys. We'd shoot them up for about an hour, they put us back in trucks, and bring us back to spend the rest of the day playing cards, going into town, or
mm-hmm.
you know. So about my last probably 3 or 4 months, in the Marine Corps was pretty good duty, because I just got to be a kind of a Caucasian dude.
Right.
So then I said, "Now this ain't for me. I'm gonna, I'm gonna get out." So I went ahead and got out, and
mm-hmm.
Went on back to California to the Bay Area.
Now you ended up joining the Air Force, is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I was out for 2 years, and I had a hard time finding a job.
Was that related to your Vietnam experience, or just in general?
No, that was a lot of my Vietnam experience, because when I went into the Marine Corps, I went in right out of high school, so I didn't have a trade. And all I did in the Marine Corps was shoot a bazooka. That was my main thing. And you know what? Let me tell you what. When you look at the help wanted section of the newspapers, you don't see many calls for a bazooka man.
Yes, sir.
They're just not out there. You know, I was off on the floor of an agency one time and said, can you operate heavy equipment? I said, no, I can blow them up, though.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up working in a warehouse and then in a lumber mill, and just dead-end jobs. And so I ran into an old high school buddy of mine, and he was home on leave. He had joined the Air Force the same time I went into the Corps,
mm-hmm.
and he was still in.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just re-enlisted, and he was home on leave. He said, "Yark, I'm joining the Air Force." "The Air Force, a bunch of candy asses. I don't want to join." He said, "Well, you say what you want, but let me tell you what we live better. I'm sure you guys did. He told me we got hot, we eat hot meals when we live in." Live in some nice facilities and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and so they'll teach you a trade. You can learn a trade that you can apply to the outside. What are you doing right now? So working in a lumber mill. You can work there till you're dead,
Mm-hmm.
He said, "So you ought to think about it." So I said, "So I give it some thought," and I said, "Well, I'm not getting anywhere here." And so I talked to a recruiter, and they said, "Well, we'll take you right to school." So I said, "I don't think I need to go to basic training." He said, No, "You got your Marine boot. You don't need to go anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take you right to school." So they sent me to supply school, which I wanted to be an aircraft mechanic. There were one of the openings at the time that said, after you're there in a while, you can cross train. So I did that. And I went into the Air Force as a supply technician. I worked there for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually cross trained into aircraft mechanic, and then finished out my career as an aircraft maintenance man. And I retired in August of 1988.
Let me ask you a couple questions about the war after you got home. Did you keep up with what was happening?
At first I didn't. At first I didn't care anything about it. But then I watched, because you wonder about your old buddies. I wonder who's over there. What are we doing? And after a while, after a few years, seen in the papers, and it wasn't, and it just kind of faded away from my memory until I got to Italy. One of my Air Force assignments was in San Vito, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for a year and a half, 75 to 76, and while I was there in 75,
mm-hmm.
the news came that we walked out of Vietnam and just left, and then it all resurfaced. I said, my goodness, I said, he just left it? We left a lot of blood and a lot of, we left a lot over there,
yeah.
And we just left. We didn't. You mean like we evacuated? Like we just packed up and said, "Oh, okay, well, we've had enough and we're gonna go."
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you talk to guys today. You say some of the best. They say, "Well, we didn't really lose that war." Well, yes, we did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how we didn't win anything.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's 58,000 plus. Who didn't come home, except
mm-hmm.
in a body bag,
Mm-hmm.
So what do we, And so at that point, Rich, I had pretty much erased most of the bad feelings and memories out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that all resurfaced when we just left.
Mm-hmm.
And I was expecting us to eventually prevail somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're the United States.
Right.
This is America, man. We don't lose things. We win things. We don't mess with nobody, but somebody messes with us. We just go do this, and it's such an empty feeling that to know that we're all over there, putting up with the stuff, and guys walking around with their lives, or hobbling along with limbs blown off and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and we just walked out. We just 14 years against a third. fourth world country that we could have annihilated in 2 weeks. But we stayed there for 14 years, drug it out, lost all kinds of guys, spent all kinds of money, and just left. You know, and oh man, I got heated up over that. And I said, man, this is, I can't believe it, that I'm seeing what I'm seeing. You know?
Right.
So.
How do you feel about your own personal service over there?
It was an experience. It was, I'm proud to be a Marine, but I hate to have killed for no reason. And, Vietnam taught me a few things. It taught me what I'm capable of,
mm-hmm.
and it also put in a hard lesson not to follow the government and take everything to do and say as gospel, and that I would never, and I won't, but will never pick up a weapon against somebody else again unless we're being attacked. Talked to my son about that too. He's looking at joining the Navy. I said, well, if you do that, that's fine. Don't make a career out of it. Because Sam doesn't honor his promises. He'll promise you the moon, but it won't be there at the end. Is the best of finding out now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that, you know, that the people who sit on their butts in Washington, and a lot of them have never served a day in the service, they have no problem at all about sending young men into harm's way for their own little games. I said, we stick our nose in places where it don't belong. And I said, I believe, you know, the freedoms we have there are worth fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
But it needs to be America. I think it needs to be us at stake. And I said that I am never going to get involved in anybody else's squabble. I said, I'll fight to the last bullet if we ever get invaded in this country. But that's what it's going to take. I said, this crap is just going over, you know, and the politicians, you know, they're not the ones that have to fight this.
Mm-hmm.
They get their kids out for college deferments and all this. A lot of these old crocs that are career politicians, the Kennedys of this world, the Schumers and the rest of them, Bushes,
mm-hmm.
they'll send you into places that they get us involved in. So all of a sudden they said, well, we send all these boys, we'll send them. What do you mean you will send them? You're working. You know, what's America's stake? Your personal pocket or something? Is that what we're dying for? So somebody can make money or what? You know, you're sitting back there and you're fat butt watching TV, watching the Rose Bowl, you know, and these poor guys are over there ducking and dodging bullets. We're still losing guys every day in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be, we should reserve a strong military, and we shouldn't be afraid to use it, but it needs to be for us, not for everybody else. We can't be the world's policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look back at my own thing in Vietnam and say, okay, I went over there, right or wrong, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
But by God, if I'd ever do it again, and they're going to have to come to our shores and say, we're taking you guys over. Then I'll stand up. I don't care if I'm 50 years old. I still got personal weapons, and I'll go out there and you fight ahead of some of the active duty guys.
Mm-hmm.
But damn if I'm going to get involved with somebody else's skirmishes. That was, it's tough when you're talking to people, and they figure they're going to get a straight answer from you because they say, well, I'll just ask them that. You know, why were we there? And I got to stand there and tell them, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? And if you don't know you were there, you don't know. Well, no, I don't. And nobody I was over there with knows.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that we're, how we're treated later on. This is really a bad deal. It really is, because one of the things that they get you to stay in with, and I did that in the Air Force. I wasn't planning on making a career or nothing, but,
mm-hmm.
in the military service, you don't make a lot of money, okay? And if you decide you don't like it, you don't just give somebody a 30-day notice and leave. You know, you can't just quit. You got to stay at least serve out your term. And while you're in the service, you pull up stakes every 3-4 years to then get to places that maybe you don't want to be. Our countries where Americans ain't all that well liked.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a family, wife and kids, you got to uproot them out of school and everything. And like I said, you don't make a lot of money. There's not a lot of teacher. If you live long enough, you stay in long enough to retire,
mm-hmm.
you can't live on it. It's not enough money unless you're a colonel or something. You can't live on it. So to keep you in, they know they have a lot worth it, a lot that they have to compete with, because they know, as you do, that your civilian counterpart that you went to school with has got in on the ground floor, and he's an executive somewhere making all kinds of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, I could be out there doing that. Why should I work for pennies and a couple of stripes? So they coped this over for you, and they say, well, but if you give us 20 years, you're going to have free medical and dental the rest of your life. You'll never have to worry about that. And that's worth a lot of money. On the outside, it's expensive. And of course, and today it's really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get down to the end, and everything changes. Everything has changed. Now you're doing out of pocket. You still get your own insurance. You can't. The VA is so underfunded that you might as well not have a VA, because it takes you 6 or 7 months to get in to see somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And to the average Vietnam vet, we're not psycho like a lot of people think. When some of you guys interview us, mm-hmm. Or people talk on the street, they think, oh man, all them guys in Nam, they're all drug nuts, and they're
mm-hmm.
they're all straight. No, there's just a lot of anger, because you got, especially the guys who made military careers, because we were over there as part of a war, that never really was declared.
Mm-hmm.
We fought a fight that nobody else wanted to fight. That's why there were so many protesters and everything. Most people in this country, and it's human nature, don't want to go out into combat. Given your druthers, you'd rather spend a day out on the lake fishing than out there having some guy trying to blow your head off.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But somebody has to do it if we're gonna reserve and preserve the freedom that we have in this country. So. But when you look at that, you can guise it as patriotism or whatever, I guess. But the Vietnam vet looks at that and he said, okay, well, I was willing to do what most of these guys would rather go to college, But I was willing to do what they didn't want to, so they could have what they have, and maybe we could have what we have. And along the lines, I was promised by our government that if we would give them a whole 20 years and go to Korea and go to everywhere else and remote assignments and give up 20 years of your life, and that's a long 20 years because there are no 8-hour shifts in the military. They could be almost 14 around the clock sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And put up with the crap. A lot of people like to be individuals, grow beards and stuff, but you can't do that in service. Everything is fit and polished, and you adhere to, and you put up with undue amount of crap, but you do it, and they keep you reenlisting because you're going to have something on the end. Now, you're not going to have a lot of money because you ain't going to make a lot of money. Your civilian counterpart is, but you ain't. But you're going to have, but the medical problems you pick up, and for those of us who have Agent Orange are really going through that right now.
Yeah, do you have?
You're going to have something on the end of it. Well, you ain't going to have nothing on the end of it because you get to the end and you find that they've all the rules have been changed. Now you can do some out of pocket. You're gonna, you got the VA, yes, you got 6-7 months at a time to wait to get in and see nobody.
Mm-hmm.
You come back to the States, Rich, and nobody gives a rat's butt. You got people protesting. You got people who've sent food, aid, and comfort to the enemy when you couldn't get shit brought in with your helicopters. Okay, and you remember that, but you remember you used to sacrifice anyway, and sacrifice to keep doing this, and then it's not there at the end. It's taking you 6 or 7 months just to see somebody. You're watching your VA clinics having to be closed down, but we've got billions of dollars for
mm-hmm.
Iraq, and we've got billions of dollars for Africa, and all the illegals in the world can come over the border, go walk into any hospital along the south and say, oh, no wabla, and they get in and they get free medical care.
Mm-hmm.
The convicted felons in prison get better care than the vets do. And they don't have to wait months for it, and it's free. The Taliban,
mm-hmm.
they captured the Taliban in Cuba. The Red Cross is there. The ACLU is there just to make sure that they got everything that they needed. The illegals are getting free care, and the vets are sitting with all kinds of things. You ought to see it in the Veterans Hospital if you've never been to one. Guys walking around there with arms missing, legs missing, hasn't been able to see a doctor. Can't afford to. Have lucrative civilian programs because you haven't been able to nest egg, because because you don't make a lot of money in the service. And when you do retire, mm-hmm. you realize that if you a little retirement pension you got, it doesn't. It might make a house payment. That's about it. You still got to go out there and compete with 20-year-olds for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get hired as a Vietnam vet is tough. That's what I was telling you yesterday. A lot of times I don't put down on a buck that I was a veteran. Just for that reason.
Right.
Because the way they're treated. They look at a 45-year-old guy, 40 or 45, he gets out of the service. And one thing his employer sees, he sees a guy that once he gets been trained, he may not be with him very long. Cause
mm-hmm.
The guy's only going to get 15 years out of him maybe, and he's going to be old enough to, you know, to totally retire. So we ain't going to get a whole lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a stigma in the mind among the people that these Vietnam guys are baby killers or psychos. You know, he's probably not right, you know. And we're just as normal as anybody else. But in our minds, man, that these guys ain't. Right. And it's tough to sometimes compete for jobs when you're at that age, and you've got to do that because your medical is not free as it was promised.
Mm-hmm.
Everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
We got money for everything else, but not for the vet. You know. Well, and
do you suffer from any disabilities? You mentioned Agent Orange. You mentioned the PTSD, the dreams that you had. Can you tell me about that?
I didn't have. The only vet that one dream about boots being in the trench, that lasted for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have it almost once every other week.
Mm-hmm.
But the Agent Orange, we were sprayed with that up the case. I was a defoliant. Well, you go through an area that's supposed to be clear, but that stuff hangs around for months.
Mm-hmm.
You're still breathing. And, of course, I have cancer from that and the diabetes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And they've linked both of them because there's no history in my family at all. And they told us, two reunions ago, the one we had in Chicago, we had a representative there from VA
mm-hmm.
talk to the Caisson Association when we were in Chicago. I don't know if you were there for that, but they told us, he said, if any of you guys have got any forms of cancer, which I didn't know I had at the time,
mm-hmm.
or diabetes or anything like that, and there's no, especially if there's no history in your family anywhere of it, you need to get to see the VA because they've linked it with Orange, and you guys were laced with it at the Caisson. It was one of the heavy regions, so you need to get in there. So I got some problems with that. And that's another thing with me personally. Not only do I carry the anger from being lied to by our own country,
mm-hmm.
being betrayed, but I've got a potentially terminal illness
mm-hmm.
from this, and I still can't hardly get in to see the VA. Now, yesterday was the first time I've been up to even in the VA in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch on TV with illegals continuing to get all this for free, and we're sending billions of dollars for this and billions of dollars, and this is all quote unquote not the government's money, the people's money.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I kept hearing all through the campaign. And we're closing down VA clinics, but we're giving medical for everybody else. And I said, you know, does the vet count for anything in here? Not that we're anybody special, but you know, if there weren't any vets, we wouldn't have what we have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so I seen a bumper sticker one time said, next time you're in trouble, call a hippie. I mean, who's going to stand up and defend this country if you didn't have people willing to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And you won't find a veteran, including the one you're talking to right now.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find a veteran that wants anything lucrative. He doesn't want any pats on the back. You know, oh, you guys are great. We're going to give you this. You know, you talk to any vet, all he wants is what was promised. He said, oh, we sacrificed for this. We got shot at. Some of us got chemicals, but we did this. Well, the rest of this country didn't have to,
mm-hmm.
so maybe our sons wouldn't have to, and you guys said there'd be some medical on the end of here, so we have a problem, and, you know, and it ain't there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we also feel like we've been used and lied to, which we have. So that's, and this thing about this PTSD and,
mm-hmm.
and all this other, and all the psychological problems, as he said, I think most of that, Rich, I feel is just anger. When you talk to a vet and you get deep into a conversation,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of this stuff comes to the surface because it's stuff that's happened and it's stuff that a lot of us have kept squelching. So when you start, you know, bringing it up and it gets to rant and raving, you say, man, you know, because we went through this and that and this is what they did, this is what they had, and we were being screwed. Often, when you're talking to a civilian, that comes across,
mm-hmm.
the civilian says, man, this guy's nuts. Well, no, this guy's in nuts. This guy's actually done this shit. And he's been hammered, and he's been kicked off to the side like he's yesterday garbage. Maybe they hope if enough of us die off, there won't be any need for any more clinics or anything like that. And they've had to close some of them that work.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's asking. They're in a vet nowhere asking us to go to the Mayo Clinic for some disease that was caused by the military, which Agent Orange certainly is. But nobody's asking. I want Dr. So and So at the Mayo Clinic. I don't expect no $50 million compensation. Well, we can compensate the Japanese, I suppose. We can, for World War II, we can compensate everybody else that thinks they got it coming. But the best thing even asked is that. All the best is that, how about a fair shake? They just deliver, we delivered our end of the bargain, Uncle Sam. How about being even with us? And for the American people, not to be looking at us as a bunch of mercenaries, because we weren't. But that's how we were portrayed. We were portrayed as the bad guys.
Well, tell me what you think about the movies and the books written on Vietnam.
I haven't seen a movie that I thought was close.
Okay.
I haven't seen Fish of the Rambo ones. I'll tell you about that one with the
mm-hmm.
rocket
yes,
launcher through that deal there.
Mm-hmm.
Full Metal Jacket was entertaining, but there were some fallacies. Did you see Full Metal Jacket?
Many times.
Well, there were some fallacies. It was entertaining, I suppose.
Was the first part the Paris Island Marine Corps basic training? Was that accurate to a point?
No. Well, some of it was. The DI physically slapping people around and screaming, yelling. Yeah, that was pretty accurate. In fact, the guy was so good, I said, man, I bet that guy's a real DI because they couldn't train an actor. Well, it turns out he is.
Right.
But the guy who played Gomer Pyle, that fat guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the guy couldn't do anything. He wouldn't, in real boot camp, he wouldn't have made it past the first week.
Mm-hmm.
He'd never been there for the whole duration.
Okay.
In near the end of the boot camp segment, when he got a full loaded magazine,
mm-hmm.
He'd have never had that needed because every round at the range is accounted for. Every cartridge case is accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd have never had he wouldn't have had any live ammo at all. And then the other thing I had to laugh at was when he came down through there during the inspection
mm-hmm.
and found a jelly donut in this guy's locker.
Mm-hmm.
I said, now where does this guy get a jelly donut? You've never seen a jelly donut in a Marine Corps mess hall. Everything is lean and green.
Mm-hmm.
So what did this guy sneak out the base, go away, wall, go to Circle K or something? where did this guy get a jelly donut?
Mm-hmm.
He's yelling at him. He says, what is this? He says, jelly donut, sir. He says, a jelly donut? He says, where did it come from? And I'm thinking, yeah, where did it come from?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It didn't come from the chow hall, buddy. So that was got the non scenes. I don't know where that was filmed, but it was realistic looking.
It was supposed to be Way City.
Yeah. Well, that could have been because most of that was looking. But I thought about that. I said, I wonder if the North, who runs Vietnam now, would allow somebody to come in and
they didn't film it there for sure. That it was just the depiction was supposed to be Way City after Tet.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, but it was something to look real. I'm not sure where that was.
Well, so many movies help shape the public's memory of events, especially.
And then these guys are
war.
Running around town. They run around this town with the hookers and stuff. And I said, man, we never got no Libby like that. What is? I'd like to have been in that outfit,
Any other movies that come to mind, or books that you've read or heard about that?
The only film that I ever watched on Vietnam is if they show something on the History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to where I don't believe Hollywood, so I can't say that there aren't any good movies out there. There might be.
Right.
I've heard it say, hey, Mike, you ought to see that one. That was pretty good. And I say, yeah, I'll bet it was,
Mm-hmm.
Was it an Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator movie or something, or who was in it? And there's no substitute for the real thing because you got to be there. You got to be there as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
To really see it. And then, too, having gone through the real thing and case on mainly, and I don't have a great aversion to watch those, although when they history runs things on Tet, I'll watch that. I'll just check for accuracy here to see if they might have. There's anybody in there I might know. Of course, they didn't film anything on 861 or 881 because there's, you know, there were never any cameras up there. The only pictures that exist up there are aerial photos and just snapshots like guys like myself might have taken up there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
Nope. We had a guy that did.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a, his name is Dennis Mannion.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis, I got a copy of the video that he took up there. He went back there. Back to Quezon and back up to 861.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows in the film where it's all grown over. And that gives you a forgotten feeling, too, because, it's, you know, it doesn't look like a battlefield anymore. It's all grown over. There's flowers growing up on that thing now. Unless you knew where it was, you'd never know there was a war ever fought up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a couple of sea rations things and a few other little mementos that he brought back. And,
mm-hmm.
I don't personally have any ambitions to go back over there. I think once was enough.
Right. If you had to speak to, say, a class full of high school students or college students about the Vietnam War, what would you tell them about it?
I would tell them if you guys are wondering anything about it, you talk to a vet. Don't believe what you read in the papers, instance, and then be proud to be an American. Stand up for the country, but stand up for our country.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
Because these politicians will get you killed in a minute for their own personal agendas. And they aren't the ones that have to do this. Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, one of the things he said was that it's a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the guy who the draft-dodging Clintons of this world and the Air National Guard Bushes of this world sent mm-hmm. over to do all this dirty work, he doesn't share in their dreams of political ambitions and personal glories and accolades.
Mm-hmm.
He's stuck out there dodging the bullets, you know. And if it was the senators and the congressmen that had to go do that, they wouldn't be so quick to get us involved in things.
Mm-hmm.
When it's somebody else, when you've got the option to send somebody else to do your dirty work, it becomes easy. If you're gonna do that, you need to take care of the guys who are willing. Most Americans, they like the color TVs, they like the SUVs, they like all the things that we have. They prefer not to have to duck and dodge bullets. Thank God there are some who are willing to do that. And the ones who are willing to do that, we need to honor our promises to those people. If we tell you we're going to expose you to this and that, you might be maimed the rest of your life or whatever, but we're going to take care of you. You know, you know, you're going to get your hospitalization if you're sick from the stuff we did, or you're missing limbs for what we've done. But don't worry about the least we can do, we're not going to make you rich, but we'll see if you get the medical care and stuff you need. You know, they need to honor that.
Right.
They need to honor that, man. And there's people making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that have never had to risk anything. You know, and I don't begrudge somebody that. You know, but if I'm going to give somebody 20 years out of my life, or in my case 22,
mm-hmm.
and duck and dodge everything that's coming and put up with the crap, I expect Uncle Sam to honor his end of it when the time comes.
Right.
You know?
Now, have you ever been to the wall in Washington?
No, I haven't been there. I've been looking at going, and in fact, I almost went this last time. I thought about going right after our reunion, but it was the 4th of July weekend. Everybody and their brother would be there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you remember, the East Coast was under heavy storms and rain.
Mm-hmm.
The town's getting flooded out, so we decided I was going to do it on this trip.
Have you seen one of the moving walls?
Yeah.
What has been your experience there?
The moving walls, I come to Boise, Idaho when I was living there. I don't know. It didn't move too much. I said, this is nice for doing this, but it ain't like seeing the real thing. I need to go back and see the real wall. I always wanted to see the real wall, and I want to see the Iwo Jima Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
At Paris Island, while I was back in Charleston, during that place, the reunion where I met you,
mm-hmm.
They took us up to Paris Island for a little day trip, and they had dedicated a range to the Quezon. Like this big monument out there, so
mm-hmm.
we all gathered around there for a ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I told you yesterday at NCRD, they had misspelled Quezon on one of the boulevards.
That's right.
you know, and that got to me, even though it's been all these years, and I still feel bitter about the whole thing. It still mattered to me that sign was not spelled right.
Mm-hmm. How did they spell it? Do you remember?
Yes, it was K-H-E, which is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the second part of that, okay, they had S-A-H-N, and it should be S-A-N-H.
Right.
And there was a girl pretended her captain in there. I was talking to her. She says, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I was there."
Mm-hmm.
"Well, you bet I'm sure."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "This is the two." And said, "You know, and this is one of the big Marine training bases. This is where you take recruits and make Marines out of them."
Mm-hmm.
"And things here ought to be right." And we lost a lot of guys.
Mm-hmm.
We lost an awful lot of guys there. We sent them that piece of crap up there. We lost too many of them for that sign to be reading wrong. He said, "Well, of course, there's a lot of paperwork, and they have to go through D.C." I said, "Well, then somebody needs to do that, because that's wrong, and especially at a boot camp base, you know, where you're teaching these guys all this stuff. You know, that needs to be correct."
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bradbury, is there anything else that you want to discuss that we have not talked about? Anything about your Vietnam experience?
No, I think we pretty much covered all. It's just something I don't think I'd. Well, like I said, I'll never do something like that again. Even if I was young enough to, I'll stand up and fight. I'll stand up and fight for us. If I had to come out of a wheelchair, stand up and fight for us. But it has to be for us now.
Mm-hmm.
I will never again. I've talked to my son about it. And I said never ever again get involved in somebody else's thing. And I said and you can't believe our government. At all, you know, Big Brother, as we call him, is just that. And I said, and don't misconstrue that, because you're talking to a real American. And I love our country, Rich. I really do. I love everything we stand for. But I don't trust the government that's running, because they'll smile at you, and they'll ram you in the back at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's where. Well, you talk to Vietnam vets, and that's why a lot of you'll probably find that you talk to a lot of guys that don't want to talk about it at all,
mm-hmm.
because of the anger, you know. And you got to get a lot of us talking, and you'll bring up stuff, because we didn't have to deal with the same things that a World War II guys did.
Mm-hmm.
We had the country; they had the country behind us. There was patriotism; we were defending America, and everything was right. The cause was right, you know. But everything here was wrong, and we were labeled wrong, and we were just cast in a real bad shadow, and then lied to when we got back. And the average vet is turmoil inside, and so a lot of them don't want to talk about it. I'm willing to talk about it for as much tape as you want to run. And
mm-hmm.
the reason I've done that, and you were talking about, you know, me being flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Hey man, I'm one of them guys where there's nobody more stirred up or pissed than me.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a chance that this story, the real stories are going to get told out there,
mm-hmm.
so maybe some generation is going to look and say, "Hey, you know what? These guys weren't the mercenaries my uncle and aunt said." Uncle Aaron, who'd never been over there, already is what they heard in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are trying to tell our story. Then our story ought to be heard, not from the Chronicle, not from the New York Times, not from the Saturday Evening Post, but from the guys that were there.
Right.
And I understand why most guys don't want to talk about it, though, because sometimes you really get ticked.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't been ticked in a while, and when you start talking about it, sometimes the more you think about it, the more angry you get. And so, you bring up things yourself that you haven't thought about for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And you get angry, and then you turn on the news, and here's all this going aid for these people, all these aid going. And you notice, of course, that these huge fires that we got going to California, you know, it's all these other countries that are coming in to help us, especially there's 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're all right there. Yeah, you betcha. Yeah, what do you guys need? Full alone. You'll never see that. Four aid goes one way. In the midst of our fires and in the midst of 9/11, if Ecuador would have had an earthquake, we'd have still sent some people down and some money and some food and supplies to help them people.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a country on this earth that we haven't helped. Sometime or another, some way or another, but it never comes this way.
Well,
and we got a government now that is more interested in helping infrastructure of other countries than our own, giving free medical. You know, and medical to me is a big thing, because it's it's something that, you know, that I need right now, along with a lot of other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we didn't get rich. We didn't make a lot of money as military people, our civilian counterparts did. But we knew that we weren't going to get rich. But we said, you know, you guys have medical problems like everybody else. We didn't know what extent, because just before he knew about the Agent Orange, and God only knows what kind of chemicals they're using now over in Iraq. And it makes me wonder what they're promising the new guys today to try to keep them in. But it's just a real bad deal.
Yes, sir. Well, we'll go ahead and end the interview now. I want to thank you for your time and sharing your stories with us. Thank you very much, sir.